And we're back, and it is the Taylor Report. And with me is Phil Conlon, Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. And Phil, you heard the interview there with Peter, and of course, you know Peter very well. I've been in many, probably been in courtrooms with him.
I can actually tell you a story. When I was a teenager, I once went to Times Square to demonstrate against President Kennedy's decision to resume nuclear testing. And I later learned from Peter, who was also a New Yorker, that he was at that same demonstration. So that would have been 60 years ago, roughly.
Yeah. So there was there's four people there.
No. There was a real pacifist movement. People didn't like nuclear testing. It was big, you know. And it was my first demonstration ever.
There were signs. Above ground nuclear testing is bad for your health.
Yeah. And which is now scientifically accepted. I mean, nobody would deny
Well, there's
it, right?
a bunch of movie stars who are dead from having said it was okay.
Yeah, that's right.
You remember they used to test. People should know this in the Nevada, Utah.
Yeah, and they would take people
desert.
Out to come as a tourist to watch
well,
it.
Well, if you read Clancy Siegel, and we do read Clancy, he wrote a novel called Going Away, but he also said in his memoirs that he was in Las Vegas at gambling, and he said and it was the middle of the night, and then they told everybody, go outside on the street, and you can see the nuclear test. And he said he went out, stood on the street, and suddenly the whole place lit up. And everybody said, oh, that was fun. Except if you were downwind from the nuclear test, and some people turned out farmers, ranchers, and in one case, a whole Hollywood crew who thought that little dust on you didn't harm you, ended up kaput. Thanks for that point. So that's your introduction to Peter.
That was my introduction to Peter.
You didn't shake hands that day.
No.
And you do recall Charles Roach?
Very well, and on many occasions. And there's so many different things he was involved in. But there was a period in the 1970s when the police in this city were shooting dead African Canadian people, most of whom were having mental health crises, and
There were incidents. The most famous is Albert Johnson.
Albert Johnson, right? And Charles Roach was always out there leading the call to bring the police to account. And because of that, of course, they said very mean things about Charles in the press. I mean, the Star and the Globe and the Sun should all remember the role they played in just like denigrating him.
By the way, that'd be a good high school.
Yeah.
You know, political science project.
Go
and read those stories.
Yeah. Yes.
And see what was being said. And we cannot say Charles Roach without mentioning Dudley Laws, who was the two of them worked together. There was the organization Bad Sea. And again, I'll just tell everybody, it's coming up on Wednesday at 7 o'clock one block above St. Clair. There's a lane being named for Charles Roach. And people should know, yes, he opposed apartheid. He also supported Nelson Mandela, but he also supported, people should know, Nelson Mandela's very good friend, Yasser Arafat. And Charles is one of the first people in Toronto to speak up on this issue. You could not talk about the subject of the Palestinians at one point. It was hard to get a public hall. It was hard to discuss it. But Charles was one of those who did. I really intended to get into that with Peter Rosenthal. Charles was anti-colonialist. He was born at a time when, as they used to say, the sun did not set on the British Empire. I'm not sure it does now, actually, because the ships tend to sail in all the oceans of the world. But anti-racism and anti-colonialism are intertwined. It's of a piece. Charles was part of that broad movement, which was international in character and which addressed the matters of colonialism everywhere. That meant that he would take on unpopular causes because it's a dirty little secret, but Canada has a lot of friends who mistreat people and who are also part of the old colonial network. So the work of Charles caused him to be at odds with the powers that be, and he didn't back down. And he had that quality that we were speaking of earlier of he was fearless. He had two great inner qualities that he was determined to be nice to anybody he met. It was never anything personal. And so anybody who tried to debate him was at a disadvantage because he always continued to like you no matter how disagreeable you were. And he also was not afraid. He didn't have any fear. And he always was comfortable. He smiled at people. And so it made him a great advocate. At any rate, well, I'm glad we're talking about Charles. I'm glad they're having this event Wednesday, 7 o'clock. I hope everybody will be there. Charles' daughters are going to be there and speak. I can't, by the way, mention this issue, the memory of Charles, without saying Hetty Roach, because I worked at Charles Roach's firm. I was the investigator for Charles, and he and I went to Africa, to Tanzania together. But whenever you went to the office, I took on any of these particularly anti-racist issues in this city. You dealt with Hetty, who was every bit as much engaged with it as Charles. And she had a similar temperament, very pleasant, very intelligent, and very committed. And so for people who are sincere sincere in their beliefs and are honest, it was a blessing to encounter Hetty and Charles, but they were people with whom you knew you could open any topic and you were going to get, both of you, you were going to get a hearing on for your point of view, and which made you respect their point of view equally. Someone said the key to speaking well is to know how to listen, and both Charles and Hetty listened. Of course, Charles had the lawyer's ear, too. He would catch the detail that needed to be worked on. It was at Charles' home I was introduced to Oliver Tambo, who, you know, unfortunately died before apartheid was eliminated completely, and was a great leader in exile at the time Mandela was in prison. And, of course, Ramsey Clark was at Charles' home on many occasions. He'd love to be there. And we all got involved at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Many people did not want Charles to do that. Because people look out for political interests rather than to follow that line of what is just, what is right. And that's how Charles made his mind up. He didn't care if a million people had a wrong point of view, and he knew it was wrong, and he knew it was unjust, he was going to take his stand that way. He wasn't a joiner. He didn't say, oh, I want to be with the majority. He followed what he knew was right. Before we go to the interview we pre-recorded, I want to mention, Phil, you know that Putin and Donald Trump are meeting.
Yes.
Are they going to meet? Is the meeting over?
I think it's over. They had a press conference.
Have they gone? They've flown home? They were met in Helsinki.
Yeah, yeah.
The American ruling circles are having a meltdown.
They are. That's a very restrained way of putting it, Phil.
Yeah. I actually had a phone call from somebody who abroad who said to me, do you think it's a good idea that Trump and Putin are meeting? And I said, how could that be a bad idea? You know, leaders of countries, particularly ones with dangerous differences, where the rhetoric is inflammatory, if they say they want to meet, seems like a good idea to me on the face of it. I can't tell you I know what they're going to say and all these things. But the principle, the same with meeting Kim Jong-un. The New York Times was afraid that Donald was going to give away, you know, everything, which would be – everything turns out to be, of course, Korean, which wouldn't be the business of the New York Times. They just absolute panic, terror. And we've gotten into this thing now where the American liberals, the people they're counting on to save them and save the country is the FBI
Yes.
And the CIA.
Yes.
And say, please save us. And I read liberal press where I would swear, reading them, that they're going to arrest him tomorrow. And articles by people who consider themselves literate and knowledgeable about Western culture, they say things like, well, we got the goods on him this time.
Yeah. And yeah, we saw him talking to that guy. Yeah, arrest him. Yeah.
And the last thing about his being there, you know, I have to remind everybody on this show, we talked about it at the time, who thought leading up to the election, he was supposed to lose, right? I mean, it was pretty much a given he was going to lose. People should remember every newspaper, major paper in America endorsed Hillary Clinton. And in the last 3 weeks of her campaign, she campaigned strictly against Putin, where she said Putin controls Trump. That was her position. And we can't have a president who has the ideas of Trump. And when Trump stood with his baseball cap on in front of his shouting admirers, he would say, oh, I love Wikipedia. And I hope if the Russians got any secrets, I hope they turn them all over and on. And I thought, well, you're dead. Politically, you're finished. I thought that puts a nail in it. He can't win saying what he was saying. So it's not a secret that he had these different opinions. It's not absolutely not a secret. He was saying it, and he still won. I was quite surprised at that because I thought, okay, you know, knowing the American psyche, I figured patriotism, you know, that one always works. You know, a president gets in trouble with a woman or a man, you know, somebody. He says, I got to go to war with a foreign country. And everybody says, well, we're behind you. And so you remember Bill with his
bombing Sudan because Monica issue.
Because Monica, the Monica yeah, issue. Yeah. So he said, I have to go to war with Sudan. And everybody said, well, we're with you. And it got him out of trouble. So I thought when Trump says, yeah, I got a thing with talking to Russians, I thought, well, you're finished. Because Hillary says that's what's wrong with you. And then she lost. And she was supposed to win anyway, hands down. So they do have a problem. We should talk to people. One of the people comes to mind is the Nation contributor, Stephen Cohen.
Stephen Cohen, yes.
I do recommend people read him because he's got his finger on this one. I mean, in terms of where the danger is and how foolish this rabid phobia is. Yeah.
Phil, if I can mention the name of the Australian commentator, Caitlin Johnstone, who is a very colorful writer.
Caitlin Johnston.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, she pointed out that Senator McCain, who of course is gravely ill and not expected to last long, is calling for a war. That she says he wants to see the world blow up in one great war before he goes. Actually, for those people who say that they're opposed to the Republicans and who really want to rant about all these things, know that McCain is leading the parade. So, I mean, are the Democrats now following John McCain? Is that what it's come to?
Well, yeah. They are, actually. Yeah. We have these group photographs with Obama and McCain and Bush. People should remember, wasn't it that the world thought Bush was an idiot? Yeah. And they said, oh, we can't wait to get rid of this guy and to get an enlightened, smart Harvard type in there. And Obama, now you can see pictures of Mrs. Obama with her arm around Bush and all of them in love with McCain. And you say,
What is this?
And you don't need me here. You guys, you all seem to like each other a lot more than any of us ever suspected. And here we are paid to suspect, and we didn't. Phil, we ought to say something about the World Cup. I'm told, by the way, if you want to see your ratings shoot up, just mention World Cup, and all of a sudden everybody would pay attention. So I would say, vive la France. In 1998, I was in Paris when they won the last time. And I was having, of all things in Paris, a spaghetti dinner. And there was a dog asleep on my foot. I remember that. I was surprised. Parisians take the dogs in the restaurant.
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
And so the dog and I were startled because all of a sudden someone shouted and France had won. And everybody left together. So I just went along with them. And then I was marching along, walking in the Champs-Élysées, pretending I pronounce these things, towards the Arts of Triumph. And women and men were waving at me from windows, and I was waving back. So, and by the way, it had the same – there's a very special quality. You cannot hide this. The team in 98 was led by an African Frenchman from – I think he was from Cameroon or maybe Senegal, Henri. And the other
Thierry Henry, right.
And the other was Zidane.
Zidane, who was French, an Algerian.
But an Algerian. Yeah. Now, this young man who got the world's attention, he's the first teenager to score a goal in the World Cup since Pelé and mark the moment, because Pelé is as big as it gets and is, you know, he's immortal in the sports world and the world, actually. And at this, he's 19 years old. His father is a Cameroonian, a coach, and his mother is Algerian. So... And we have to mention.
And he's
these
a Parisian.
Things.
He's born in Paris.
He's born in Paris. Yes. Of course he is.
Yes.
And but what we have to say is, you know, the because it's inevitable, race in these cultures, I mentioned Charles Roach earlier, colonialism, racism are all intertwined. And going into the 98 games, Mr. Le Pen was making a big thing of it. These players weren't French. He got buried politically for about 10 years.
Yes, he did. He really
as a result
stuck
of
his foot in
saying such things because everybody said, well, that's all well and good, but we'd like to have a winning team.
Yeah.
And we'd like to be a great culture, a great society. And I thought it was, a delicious moment. Now, by the way, it doesn't solve the issue of race at all. It's just, you know, it's still very much evident. But what is also evident is that, yes, this empire – the people who lived in that empire are, of course, there. And there needs to be appreciation, respect. And it is, one hopes that they will draw the appropriate lessons from it, and the world will. I think we should congratulate Russia on organizing apparently a very successful games.
By everybody's report, the fans had a wonderful time. It went very well. In particular, England, because the fans from England stayed around much longer than they had expected they would, because their team did a lot better than they expected it would. And in the English press these days, I mean, if anybody says anything negative about the Russians, they're laughed at. People are coming back from England and saying, what a wonderful place, what wonderful people, right? And it's very hard to get you want to hate somebody and fight a war when you're visiting the country and say, gee, well, we like the people here. They're really nice to us.
Yes.
You know?
And they kind of remember that we used to be friends and we were fighting something called Nazism.
Yes.
They have big statues saying it was a good thing. Maybe we should look into that. That was an important part of it. There is a writer for the Washington Post who wrote an ignorant piece, and I urge people to look at the comments of the press secretary for the Foreign Ministry of Russia. You can find it, thank heavens, to the internet, Zakharova. And she said they were disappointed in this piece that the woman had written because she said Russians are uncomfortable with diversity. And she said, this person has to be illiterate or, you know, not been out and around in Russia. Russia is extremely diverse, ethnically diverse. The word Russian doesn't describe.
Right.
If you think you're talking about a certain ethnic group, you're not.
There's actually an Irish journalist who lives in Moscow who went and did the trouble to research the ethnicity of the Russian team, and he says this is the most diverse team in the competition. By the way, including a Brazilian who became a Russian citizen. It's interesting. The person in the Washington Post who wrote that article didn't comment on the Croatian team, but there was
Well, but no, she. And the other thing, she had, after all, she passes this along to the Washington Post, Washington Post somewhat respectable at one time, not
at
to me,
time,
but there are people who regard,
you
have to read the posts, you have to read the New York Times. But this was parochial and ignorant. And Zakharova pointed out in the press conference, she said, a reporter there said, well, you said that the woman is not known. And I want you to know that I do know her. And Zakharova said, yes, you're one of the few, actually, who knows. She says she never comes here to these press briefings. She phones us once in a while. But she said, I can't tell you that I think she's a good journalist because that is such an ignorant thing to write. And it's malicious, and you know that the intention is to try to smear the games and Russia, etc. Some of that was done in the Globe and Mail, by the way. There were a lot of papers.
A lot of it was done in the Globe and Mail. And it was terrible. Yeah.
Remember that at one point, because of the Skripal story, right. Which is Skripal rhymes with script, but a scripted story, it's a strange story, which, you know, all the trails lead nowhere, yet ambassadors are recalled and we go on a war footing or some crazy thing. They were very close to trying to sabotage the games entirely. And had they been the good old empire that they were when Charles Roach was born, they would have sabotaged the World Cup. They would have said nobody goes and all their colonies would have to obey and nobody would go and they would destroy the games if they could. Again, it seems to be, use the soccer term, I guess, or they were wrong-footed because now this is just another knock against the conservative government of England because they played it so foolishly. And they were doing it in league with their NATO friends, but particularly the Americans who were pushing this. And because Trump is such a contrary personality, May made the mistake of trying to go down that road, and she didn't gain anything. She lost ground as a result. But they were very successful. I really hope Will Smith was there. Do you know the Will Smith, the Hollywood star? You've heard of Will
Smith.
Yeah, of
course.
I don't know what Phil follows his movies, but
I certainly know Will Smith.
So Will Smith was one of the people singing or performing. And he said he really hopes the American people will begin to play football as opposed to that game they do play, that they call football.
Good for him for saying that.
I really hope we'll get to the point where we talk about football because I'm told by people who speak other languages, I'm not capable, that, of course, football is the word that is used. In North America, we have to say soccer. Am I right about it? Is that your impression?
That's right. The game is called football everywhere except Canada and the United States.
Yeah. And
maybe Australia. I don't know. I'm not sure because they have a game like
if you
American
have not
football.
Seen it, yeah. John Cleese has a clip. You just put John Cleese football, and then you will laugh yourself silly, where he gives a lecture. On football.
Well, yeah, you use your foot. You see, that's the key point.
He holds up his foot and he says, foot, and he holds the ball. He said, there's a clue in the name. Well, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We should also say, I think, that the people of Thailand, their military, their government, anybody who pulled off that miracle of saving those boys, you have to admire. And they, it gets your attention. You focus. The young man, 25 years old, the coach, right? He had great mental power. He had some training. I think he is a Buddhist. But they talk about how the things he knew to do. Can you imagine? You've got 11 boys, and they're in a cave, deep in a cave, and water has cut them off. Have you ever been, by the way, in a cave when there's no light? Have you ever done that?
I've never done that.
You cannot see your hand. You cannot. You know you have a nose, but you can't see. There's nothing like it. And yet, there they were. And also we give everybody credit, the British divers who first found them, when none of them, only one of them spoke English. He was from Myanmar, and so when the diver pops up suddenly out of the water, and flashes his light on them and begins to talk to them, no one understood him except this boy, who then he was able to communicate with him. There is a writer who lives in the region, a brilliant writer, Cartolucci, I think. I hope I got his name right. But he has a website called, of all things, Land Destroyer. He's one of the smartest writers on the planet in terms of understanding issues. And now is the time to take a look at his site. It's called Land Destroyer. He lives in Thailand. But he gives you background. I don't think he's updated it. At the time he was writing, the last column he wrote, he was... It was just they had been found, but they hadn't yet been rescued. But he gives you wonderful political background. And he takes up an issue that the Taylor Report is very interested in, Myanmar. And he's asking why the Western powers are so interested in this. And he mentioned it's a country called China who has economic ties and business in the region. And everywhere they seem to be having some success, like helping develop, build a port or build a railroad, the Americans and the Canadians and the British have found a group that they sympathize with or are very interested in and want to make sure that there's maximum trouble in the area. And there's a solution in the region has been worked on. It's a regional solution. It doesn't involve Washington, London. But that is being obstructed by people here who want to see how much trouble they can make. Read the Land Destroyer, his site, and I know you're all very brilliant and you will find it and know more about it in about 30 minutes than I do. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're very appreciative of Febby, and we hope to see you next week.